Dr. Thomas Glenn is a pediatric cardiologist at Texas Children's Hospital and an assistant professor at Baylor College of Medicine. He did his pediatric cardiology fellowship at UCSD Rady Children's Hospital and completed a fourth-year advanced fellowship in single ventricle and advanced cardiology at the University of Michigan, CS Mott Children's Hospital. Dr. Glenn's clinical interests focus on caring for children with congenital heart defects disease, both inpatient and outpatient, seeing and managing patients in the single ventricle interstage program, Fontan-Go multidisciplinary clinic, and the cardiac exercise lab. Tom's research interests focus on the outcomes of individuals with Fontan circulation and the many sequelae of the Fontan procedure, the impact of exercise in CHD patients, and mental health outcomes in CHD patients. He is on the executive leadership team of the Fontan Outcomes Network, a multi-center learning network aimed at improving the long-term outcomes of individuals living with Fontan circulation. Dr. Glenn is an individual living with Fontan circulation himself, having undergone staged palliation in the early 1990s. Welcome to the show, Dr. Glenn.
Thank you so much, Patrick. I'm really excited to be here today. As a regular listener, it's exciting to be speaking with you on the podcast.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. You're kind of like the culmination of of the guests we have, you know, somebody who is a doctor in the field of pediatric cardiology with a focus in single ventricle heart disease and a patient yourself. So very excited to have you on.
Yeah, it's certainly a unique position I'm in, but I wouldn't change it any other way.
Well, so let's get right into it. Normally, I ask people how they became familiar with the world of CHD, but for you, I think it may be a little different. So tell us your story growing up with a congenital heart defect. How did you become aware of your condition? How did you grow from there?
Yeah, so, you know, I was born back in 1990 with hypoplastic left heart. And, you know, at that time, my parents had not had any prenatal diagnosis or really any ultrasounds throughout the pregnancy. I think things were pretty different back then. But, you know, shortly after I was born up in San Francisco, it was discovered. And, you know, I was shipped off to a larger children's hospital. That's when my parents kind of found out what was going on with my heart. And, you know, back in 1990, there was not really a whole lot of options for babies born with my condition, especially if you weren't at a place that had been familiar with some of the surgical options, like on the East Coast at Boston and Philadelphia. So many of the surgical options were very novel, really had just kind of come around within the last few years, and definitely hadn't really reached Northern California at that time. But, you know, in discussions with my parents, they were kind of given three options. Transplantation was on the table, but that would obviously require them to relocate somewhere, which didn't really work with them. They could just, you know, go through palliative care and kind of let nature take its course. And that was actually the course that they had recommended my parents take. And the other option, which was, again, pretty unknown at the time, but a three-stage palliation. But, you know, my surgeon, or who was going to become my surgeon, I basically told my parents he had never had a survivor leave the hospital following a Norwood with a hypoplastic left heart. So that was an option, but didn't seem like a very good option. So, you know, it was kind of an impossible decision by my parents, but thankfully they ultimately chose to go through the stage palliation. I had my Glenn procedure at UCSF, you know, several months later after the Norwood, and then I had my Fontan at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. So luckily they gave me that, you know, chance to grow up. I've been pretty lucky, done quite well. I think one of the biggest things my parents did growing up was treat me very normally. They didn't let my congenital heart disease or anything that I was dealing with from a medical standpoint kind of stand in the way of what I wanted to do and accomplish. Pretty much anything I told them I wanted to do, they let me do and they encouraged me to do, from sports to Boy Scouts to hiking the Grand Canyon a couple times, and then going to med school. They just, you know, encouraged me to do everything. And their line of thinking was, what's the point of doing all these surgeries if we're just going to sit you in a bubble and not let you do what you want to do? So I think that, you know, made me a more resilient individual. And I think a lot of the things I've done throughout my life as a result of that are kind of just due to the way I was parented.
Okay, so I have to ask, your last name, Glenn, are you any relation to Dr. Glenn?
Absolutely not. I always make the joke to people, especially, you know, in my field, everyone knows that. They always ask, but that's not the case. And it just so happens that I also have a Glenn. So it's kind of a weird situation, but no, absolutely no correlation.
just had to ask because it always pops up when I hear your name. I'm like, I wonder if he's related to Dr. Klein.
It happens a lot with my patients.
Okay. So at what point did you become interested in pursuing a medical career?
I think, just being around medicine your whole life and kind of going through everything that you go through with the CHD from the moment you're born, I think there's just some like automatic, intrinsic kind of interest that you have with it. At least for me, that was the case. And I was always just very interested with the way the body worked, especially, cardiac physiology. And as I got through college, I was a physiology major. So I was taking extra classes looking at the heart and how the heart worked. And it was just an area I was always very interested in. I knew I enjoyed working with children. I volunteered with children. And I liked the fact that if you were in the medical field and you were working with children, you could follow them for their whole lives until they became an adult and then you transfer the care. So, for me, pediatric cardiology just seemed like the right fit. Now I'm a pediatric cardiologist caring for children with, the same diagnosis as myself, among, many other things. It was something that just at a young age, I was always interested in, and it kind of just stuck with me. There was a point where I tried other things out just to see if I was interested in anything. But every time I tried to look at another field of medicine or something in the business world, I was just brought right back to medicine just because I think my, inherent, everything that was going on with me just forced me back into it.
Yeah, that makes sense. You're basically intrinsically connected to the medical world.
Yeah, but there was a point where I was wondering, do I really want to mix my personal life and my career, seeing patients that are going through very difficult times, same thing I could be going through. And it did take, a lot of looking inside of me to really see if that's something I wanted to do. And ultimately I did because I thought I could help these patients.
That's good. So I wonder, do you see a lot more single ventricle patients at your hospital than say other pediatric cardiologists just because of your intimate familiarity with the disease?
I see a lot of single ventricle patients, both the single ventricles who are young in the interstage period between the first and second palliation. And I also see a lot of Fontan patients who have, finished the stage operations and are now, at least four or five and have their Fontan. And that's really just because my specialty within pediatric cardiology, I'm kind of embedded in those Fontan multidisciplinary clinics and the single ventricle clinic. So, myself and a couple other physicians at Texas Children's, we rotate on a weekly basis and kind of see those patients in those specialty clinics. So that's why I'm seeing those patients. In my general cardiology clinic, I see a lot of the regular stuff that people get referred to, chest pain, passing out, VSDs, ASDs, kind of more bread and butter cardiology. But the reason I'm seeing those other patients is because of my extra training that I did.
Good deal. So you are involved in the Fontan Outcomes Network.
Yes.
As I guess you're on the board now, right?
Yeah, I'm on the executive leadership team. I'm kind of the patient lead for that group.
Okay. So how did you get involved in the Fontan Outcomes Network?
Yeah, so my journey through all of this kind of began back when I was in college, undergrad actually, before med school. I was actually asked to give a talk at NPC-QIC, so the National Pediatric Cardiology Quality Improvement Collaborative. I was asked to kind of give a talk about my own personal experience as someone living with single ventricle heart disease. I gave a talk at the learning session in Dallas that year, and I stayed around for the whole meeting, and I was just really amazed by all the work that they were doing. NPC-QIC really focuses on hypoplastic left heart syndrome, and especially the time between the first and second surgery, and how that basically improve outcomes during that period of time when kids are at such high risk. And I was just really enthusiastic about their work. And after asking a few people that were kind of leaders in that group, I became more involved as a patient advocate throughout my time in med school and then eventually as resident. I was giving talks with them every once in a while. I was involved in some of their efforts. And I think just my involvement in that made my name kind of well known throughout the organization. When the Fontan Outcomes Network was being created 3 or 4 years ago, I was asked to join as, the ELT patient lead by some of those organizers. And, Fontan Outcomes Network really focuses a little bit more on the long-term outcomes and the long-term sequelae for everything after the Fontan procedure. In a nutshell, both organizations have very similar goals and what we want to accomplish, but the FON really focuses on everything after the Fontan. There's so many different questions that us Fontan patients and families have that we haven't answered yet. this surgery's only been around for several decades, and the patients who have done well are just now into their 30s, 40s, and in some cases, 50s. So there's a lot about the future that we don't know. There's a lot of variability in the way that Fontan care is delivered around the country and especially around the world. And we hope that by building this registry, that we can really catalog every patient's journey and all of their information. We can really start to answer those questions, both for clinicians and for families who are asking these questions.
What's going on in NPC, QAC, or FON right now that you're most excited about?
One of the things about these two organizations, and they're very similar in the sense that they both bring in patients and families as equal partners. They have providers, they have nurses, nurse practitioners, cardiologists. They have all these people, the usual suspects. But what these organizations do that you don't see in many other organizations is they bring in these other patients, family partners. And that's something that I don't think you'll see with many organizations. And I think that's something that makes them special. I think having them as equal stakeholders really lets them push or drive care forward. You get them as equal stakeholders and they get to ask the questions that other people may not have asked. They get to get other patients and families involved, which again, you just don't see many places that are doing that. So that's, I think, one of the reasons I enjoy being a part of this organization. I think as we continue to grow, building that community of patients and family members is going to be really big. The other exciting thing, right now is that we do have a registry. We have over 530 patients in the Fontan registry now. And, we're hoping to get to 10,000 over the next several years. There's a lot of data we need to collect. So understandably, the research coordinators at each of these institutions that's involved has a lot of data to input, but as we get more and more data and more patients enrolled, hopefully we should be able to answer some of those questions. How do patients that are on this medication do long-term as opposed to this medication? Or, there's different types of Fontan. What's the most optimal type of Fontan or fenestration? Things like that, there's been some suggestion and some data that's out there, but nothing on as large of a scale as what we're trying to create here, hopefully in the next several years.
Right. I think that's a really important point about having the diversity of opinions.
Yeah.
Because I did a webinar interview with another clinician who's been working on this problem for about two decades now. And she said there was a very big sea change once they got the parents and patients involved, because what was important to those groups were different than what was important to the medical professionals. And I remember her, she would show, this was the top 10 from the medical side and this was the top 10 from the patients. And there'd always be some that overlapped, but
of course
there were the top priorities on the patient side was stuff like day-to-day living, mental health. The top priorities from the medical side was kind of long-term outcomes. And both those are important, but if you favor one over the other, then you can lose the ball game.
Absolutely. I agree with what you're saying. I think for the last several decades in the medical world, the kind of focus has just been on survival of these patients. And that's, why the surgeries were created was just to have survival. But now that we have pretty good survival for these patients, we really need to focus on the fact that we want them to thrive throughout the lifespan. And in order to thrive, things like mental health, exercise, things like that need to be enforced. And that's some of the priorities that patients and families bring that may not have been thought about if it was just the providers that were running the show. So I totally agree.
Yeah, it's kind of like how your parents were saying, why would we go through all this trouble just to put somebody in a bubble, right?
Exactly.
Let's give them the best life we can.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So I know one of your specialties is exercise, or one of the things you're really pursuing. I'm very excited about that. And it seems like more every time I go back to, NPC-QIC, the learning sessions, there's a new paper out that shows exercise is even more important than the last time we talked about it. What are you seeing on that front, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, historically, similar to the whole survival thing, the messaging has very much changed in terms of exercise. When I was growing up, no one talked about exercise. And in a way, people were scared to let us go off and run and do whatever we wanted because they were worried that, there may be some sudden cardiac event. Well, it turns out that's not really the case. And there's a lot of patients with congenital heart disease, but also single ventricle heart disease. They do a lot of physical activity and really everyone does quite well. there is some data out there to show that the serial exercise testing that we do at our yearly or biannual visits, where they put you on the treadmill and make you run, which I know every patient absolutely loves, there's some data to show that some of the first signs that you see for some of these patients who start to not do well and maybe have some Fontan, circulatory failure, you can see some of that in those numbers. And over time, you may see a decrease in their basically oxygen consumption. So one of my areas of interest is exercise, and specifically seeing how exercise or those results from the exercise test maybe can predict some of those outcomes long-term. And if it can maybe be, like a scarlet letter that if you see this decrease in VO2 over the 2 years, maybe there's something on the horizon that you need to be more aware of. I'm also just very much interested in how formal exercise prescriptions and formal exercise rehab may actually also improve patients' outcomes. I think there's a lot of benefits to exercise that we're discovering right now. And I think the overall gestalt is that exercise is good for patients with congenital heart disease. I think ideally, patients would be doing at least 4 or 5 days per week of at least moderate level intensity exercise. I know everyone's not doing that, but I think that would be the ultimate goal. And, a lot of cardiologists, unfortunately, are just not super comfortable talking about exercise. I think we're getting better at it. But the reason when I was at Michigan for my fourth year, we created this exercise prescription where we would give our patients a formal, basically like a medication prescription, but it was for exercise. And based on some of their results from their exercise test and some of their anatomic findings, so how their heart was pumping and how everything looked, we would be able to tell them, okay, you should be doing this at this level of intensity, this many days a week. And with the information, we hope, and this is kind of the next step, is to see if patients, one, will follow that, and two, how long-term, how that actually helps them. Because it's one thing to just go in the patient room and say, all right, you need to exercise more, you're not doing anything. That's not going to, the patient's going to be like, well, what do I need to do? If you went and told right. someone, you need to start taking this medication, you don't tell them anything about the medication, you don't tell them how often they're taking the medication, they're not going to start the medication. They're going to not know what to do. So it's just the same with exercise. You have to have a conversation with the patient. You need to tell them why it's important. You need to tell them how often and what kinds of exercises they need to do. And unfortunately, that's just been one of the deficiencies in our field for the last several decades. And I think there's definitely a lot of people that are buying into it. And hopefully over the next 10 years, we'll see a complete flip of the script with when it comes to exercise.
Well, I'm very excited for that because I think all the data pretty much shows that it's not simply a matter of choice, it's kind of almost a necessity.
Absolutely. And I think we have some data that shows the importance of it. Now it's just making sure that gets to the patient in the correct way and they feel comfortable going out and exercising.
Good deal. To come back to the Fontan Outcomes Network, being a part of the organization, what's kind of your goals in the short term?
Similar to what the goals of the actual organization are, I really, during my time with these organizations, I just want to see long-term outcomes improve. I want patients to feel like we're actually answering their questions and taking their questions seriously. Many patients have been asking for a long time, why are we doing this liver imaging if it's not changing anything? Why am I on this medication? What's it doing for me? And I think a lot of it is just, the way we've practiced medicine for many years, but I hope that with this data and this registry and some of the care projects we're doing, we'll actually be able to answer some of those questions with data. I want patients to feel like they're heard. I want patients to feel like they're getting answers to their questions. I know a lot of that probably will be more of like a long-term goal, but for a more immediate goal, I really just want to see more patients added into the registry. We have this goal of 10,000 patients into the registry, and we're getting there. It's going to take some time. But I also hope as we get more patients into the registry and we start to get more data that we can improve patient engagement. NPCQIC has done a really good job of getting parent involvement in their organization. And if you go to one of their learning sessions that happen twice a year, probably a third to half of the people at the learning session are parents of individuals with single ventricular heart disease. It's pretty amazing to see that. One of the things we're working on is the same thing with Fontan Outcomes Network. We'll probably get several parents, but I hope we can also get those patients since these tend to be, it's after the Fontan. So these are older patients who are childhood, early teen, and adults. I would really like to see patient engagement really improve over the next several years and start to see more of them at the learning session. I also want to see care centers and hospitals actually see this effort and understand why it's important that they should put money and resources into staying involved. It's one thing to commit to putting data into the registry, but I want them to take that next step where they actually figure out who is a patient partner or a patient champion at their center. And, oh, let's fly them to the learning session so that they don't have to do that on their own dime. I think that buy-in from the care centers is one of the really big goals I have. And I think if we can achieve that, that will really show that everyone understands the importance of this effort.
Taking into account both MPC QIC and Fontan and your current medical career and the portions of that you're involved in, what is kind of your hope to personally accomplish?
You know, from a career standpoint, my ultimate goal is just for my patients who have CHD or single ventricle heart disease. I just want them all to live their lives to the fullest. I think that's really all we can ask. I want them not to feel like they're too limited by their underlying diagnosis. I really hope that the messaging I give them when I'm counseling them, I hope that they see that they can do the things that they want to do. And just because they unfortunately were born with this abnormality, it does not mean they're not able to live a long, fruitful life. That, to me, is my ultimate goal. And that's what when I eventually retire at some point, I will feel very accomplished if my patients overall were able to live good lives and felt like they could do the things they wanted to. From a more leadership kind of standpoint, I really hope in the future I can be the lead or a director of a cardiac exercise lab and maybe be a leader of a Fontan multidisciplinary clinic. My time at Michigan in my fourth year, and then now as a junior faculty member, I'm involved in this very large exercise lab and Fontan multidisciplinary clinics, and I'm working and learning under other people who are more experienced than me. But I hope that advisement and that leadership I'm learning from them will translate to my own leadership opportunities in the future at, you know, a cardiac center where I can lead those efforts.
Very good. So switching gears a little bit, thinking about, you know, yourself as a patient, what kind of things do you see kind of on the horizon that are exciting to you?
Yeah, so I think the exercise stuff, like we just discussed, is one of the big things that we're going to get more information about. And I think we'll see a lot more formal recommendations for exercise, hopefully come over the next several years. And hopefully more cardiologists will be comfortable discussing these things. So I think that's one of the big things on the horizon. I think that there are going to probably be more drug trials. I think there's several pharmaceutical companies that have been looking at different medications that may optimize the Fontan circulation. And I think there's some interest among some of those companies to test some of these medications and see whether they can be beneficial for this patient population. And you know, if they can demonstrate that, I think we may see some FDA approval for some of these medications, which hasn't really happened in the field of pediatric cardiology really ever. And there's not very much that's FDA approved, if at all. I think those are two of the big things. And then from Fontan long-term outcomes, I just hope that we can, once we have a lot of patients in the registry, we can start to answer some of these questions and start to kind of catalog what types of things lead to better outcomes. And who knows, maybe in 5 or 10 years, we'll be saying, why were we doing that the whole time? That leads to worse outcomes. And while that might not be a good thing, I think it'd be pretty cool if we could change the way things are done through some of this data that we're able to receive.
All right. So from your short bio that I read at the beginning, it also mentioned that you were interested in helping with mental health outcomes in CHD patients. What's sort of your thrust on that front?
Yeah, that's another thing that, like, the exercise piece has really burst into the scene over the last several years. And I would say even more than the exercise component, this is something that's being recognized by pretty much all the different organizations within the CHD community, which is great. The normalization of what can happen after any form of cardiac repair or just living with congenital heart disease, there's higher incidence of anxiety, depression, PTSD, developmental delay, all these things has really come about recently. And the importance of normalizing these from the cardiologist standpoint, I think a lot of cardiologists will say, I'm not a mental health expert. And I think a lot of people, luckily, you know, thanks to a lot of psychologists, are saying you don't have to be a mental health expert just to talk to your patients and ask them these questions. Sure, if you're really concerned and you feel like they need to see someone, then we can get you a referral. But there's a lot you can do in just a short 15, 20 minute visit as a cardiologist. And I think there's been a lot of improvement of that. I think a lot of people are comfortable asking the questions now. I'm also very interested in resiliency, that belief that patients or people can bounce back after some type of difficult time or difficult event. And we just finished a research study that got published in the Journal of the American Heart Association that patients with congenital heart disease were actually more resilient than those without. And this was looking at adolescents and young adults with congenital heart disease, which I thought was really interesting. There's definitely limitations to the study, but one of the most important things I think we saw was the patients who were more resilient within those CHD, that CHD cohort, the ones who exercised more, the ones who had better social support, the ones who attended CHD heart camps, and the ones who were having their mental health treated ended up having better resilience, which I think that just speaks to everything we're trying to do. So promoting some of those things may in fact make your patients more resilient. And there's a lot of other people, you know, in the CHD community that are researching different things within mental health and different interventions that can be done to hopefully improve those outcomes as well.
Good deal. Let's say I'm a parent or I'm a patient who's listening to the podcast. What advice would you have for them if they wanted to get involved?
Yeah. So I think if you want to get involved with MPCQRC or FON, I think the first thing you really need to do is look at your care center, wherever you know your child or yourself is getting care, and go to them first and ask, hey, are you involved in MPCQRC or FON? If they're not, then there's an easy first step. You need to push them to do that. They need to understand, one, what they're missing out on, and two, how important it is for the patients and parents that some of these research efforts and some of these care projects are not being done with their patients in mind. For those who are getting care at a center that is involved, I think the next thing you can do is reach out to the clinical lead at each care center. There's always going to be someone who can direct you into some of the projects that are ongoing at the center and how you can become involved, whether you want to participate yourself or you just want to be involved in those efforts. And then I think one of the biggest things someone can do if you have the time and the resources is actually attend a learning session. Learning sessions occur twice a year. Usually in the spring, there's a virtual session. And then in the fall, we have an in-person learning session. That's a really great way to get involved and really see firsthand what the learning sessions and what the networks are about and some of the things that we're doing. Having the patients and parent at the table at those learning sessions is really the best way to change the way care is delivered at that center. So I would encourage you, any of those things are going to be helpful. But I think ultimately, if you can get to one of the learning sessions, I think you'll leave very enthusiastic. And I guarantee you probably won't want to stop being involved.
Very true. That's been our experience as well as parents. So very good advice. All right. So this is a curveball question. It's not one I sent you. So you're on the spot. You don't have to answer it if you don't want to. But
all right.
One of the reasons we started this podcast was because as a member of a lot of the social media organizations, and especially Facebook groups and whatnot for parents, we see a regular stream of people who get the diagnosis in utero, you know, after the ultrasound, talk to a cardiologist who is not up to date.
Yeah.
And are basically painted a very bleak picture.
Yeah.
And my question to you is, if you encounter somebody who's gone through that, what kind of advice or what kind of hope could you share with them?
Yeah, I think the social media groups, there's some good and there's, you know, obviously some bad with, as with anything with social media. I think one of the best things that the social media groups does, and something I try to do sometimes on those groups, is parents often leave these first visits thinking that their child will never be normal or never have an opportunity to even have a normal life or anything close to a normal life. And I think those groups, when someone posts one of those things, they are often flooded with an influx of parents and patients who are doing well, living a pretty darn normal life. And I think seeing that is one of the most important things that those social media groups can do. I think one of the difficult things is that everyone's journey is different. There is a lot of different complicating factors, a lot of differences in diagnoses and things that can happen during surgery and after surgery, that just because you see that so-and-so is doing well does not always mean that that's going to be the case. But I definitely think that this day and age, if you know you're diagnosed with some form of single ventricle heart disease in utero, I think there's a very good chance that you're going to live a very normal life and have the potential to do that. Sure, there's challenges along the way, as with any chronic illness, but I think the potential to have a very, very good life is there. And I think that is one of the things that those groups does a good job of showing.
Very good. Good answer. And then, so my final question, if I find myself in Houston, Texas, in your branch of the woods, because if you've never been to Houston, it's a giant city.
It's huge.
It takes more than an hour to drive from one side to the other.
Yeah, it might be two, depending on traffic, it's big.
So if we're in your area, where do I have to go eat?
Oh, well, I love some good barbecue. I think Killen's Barbecue, Killen's Barbecue, is probably the best barbecue I've had out here. The brisket is to die for. A lot of people would probably be expecting me to say Tex-Mex, but having grown up in San Diego and Arizona, I think the Tex-Mex is a bit overrated, and I'll probably get a lot of hate for that. But I would go with some good barbecue, like at Killen's, if I was here.
Well, you know, when you're in Texas, those are the two answers, right? It's either the Mexican or the barbecue, so you can't really go wrong there. So
no, you can't go wrong. I grew up around, you know, some of the best Mexican food, so I'm a little biased.
Well, very good. Very good. And very happy to have you on. Is there anything else you wanted to cover, wanted to share?
I think I hit all the points. I think for families that are listening, always happy to talk on a personal level, not like necessarily a medical level, but you can always email me at Glenn, GLENNTM3@gmail.com. I'm always, you know, there just to talk about any, you know, personal journey or anything that people want to discuss. So feel free to reach out.
Awesome. Like I said, thank you so very much for joining us. We really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. And I really appreciate what you guys are doing. It means a lot.
You're welcome. And thank you again. And I'm sure as Fond grows and we move on to new initiatives, I'm going to try and get you on the show at least a couple more times.
I look forward to it.
Thank you again, Dr. Thomas Glenn.